Welcome to Stoma and Continence Conversations from Coloplast Professional. I'm Hannah, Ostomy Care Associate Education Manager at Coloplast. Working in specialist care, I know that stoma and bladder and bowel issues impact the lives of those you care for. This podcast is here to support your educational needs and help you in supporting your patients. You'll hear from fellow healthcare professionals and experts by experience discuss the latest hot topics in the world of stoma, continence care, and specialist practice. Hello, and welcome back to the podcast. We're bringing you another one of our webinar Wednesday chats today, as Paul is joined by the wonderful Dr. Terry Porritt to talk about writing case studies. So let's get into it straight away. And first off, Terry explains why case studies are so important.
Well, I think case studies are really, really important, Paul, and potentially more powerful than a formal article for publication. A case study is a snapshot of your clinical practice. It's either about a clinical challenge and how you've solved that for an individual patient, or it's a snapshot of the challenges you're facing within your practice with workload, with getting people to understand the importance of things that you do. For example, I can remember back at the Homerton, people saying to me, Terry, your team does an awful lot of telephone calls. You know, these are just social catch-up chats to your patients. No, these are really important clinical follow-ups. And I put in one year in my annual report what I called, I didn't call it a case study, but it was what I called a snapshot of. This is what I achieved on one telephone check to a patient. And I gave, obviously anonymized, and it was a 75-year-old, I think 8 weeks post-op. It was in the summer. They had a loop ileostomy. This lady had issues already with a high output from her stoma. And we were now in the peak of summer. And I knew there was a significant risk of her becoming dehydrated. As it was, during the course of this telephone chat, I found out that she had over 1.5 litres output a day. Her GP had stopped prescribing her Imodium because he didn't think it was important, and that when she got out of the chair, she felt really dizzy, postural hypertension. Okay, we dealt with all of that with the GP in the space of an hour. That prevented, as I could say really clearly, this person falling at home, coming into casualty, being admitted to hospital, needing 24 hours IV. So we solved that with this not really very important to our manager's telephone check. So that was the power of a very simple case study showing one intervention that I did and ensuring that my managers understood the importance of these non-social ringing up for a little chat. These are clinical interventions on the telephone. People don't realise it. That one snapshot, no more issues. And actually, we then had dedicated telephone clinics put into our job plans to do all of these because they were so important.
There's so many points I almost want to pull out from there, things that you've said, and it really does highlight, you know, and again, it's that word thing. People say, you know, your managers, saying you're just doing a social chat. I remember one of the things that I was always taught at CNS was we never chat with anybody. You know, we talk about that, the language to use and that sort of thing. And again, for the Apollo website, the link is here on this webinar. And we talk about how to talk about your service with managers, because a lot of time managers have absolutely no idea in what we do as CNSs. A lot of the time we are expensive numbers at the bottom of a spreadsheet. We are very, very expensive commodities. One of the things I would like to talk about, because we know that in the world at the moment, and it's only getting worse, workload of specialist nurses is just getting higher and higher, and there's more demands on the service, there's more demands on each individual clinical nurse specialist. And I'm not being overdramatic, but we've been hemorrhaging senior clinical nurse specialists, and they're not being replaced, or we're finding it difficult to replace clinical nurse specialists in any kind of speciality. And there's been a lot in the nursing press recently, and you look at Twitter, you look at all of those, and you hear a lot of nurses talking about the anxiety and the negative impact of work left undone, because there is just so much going on. Are case studies just an added thing to that? Can it support with work left undone? Can you explain what work left undone actually is?
Well, Paul, everything you've said is so pertinent to the time at the moment and more relevant to me in my work outside of Coloplast as well as inside of Coloplast, because I have the privilege at the moment of being an RCN council member. And obviously, the whole focus of the RCN at the moment is about the workforce, well-being and retention of nursing staff. And what is really clear is that it's moral distress. So no nurse, no specialist nurse, no stomach care nurse goes to work each day going, do you know what? I'm going to be horrible at work today and I'm going to leave that undone and I'm not going to do this and I'm not going to ring that patient who I told I was going to ring. Nobody goes to work like that. But that's the reality of how we leave work on many days going, do you know what? I didn't get enough time. I wanted to spend more time with that patient talking about A or B. I wanted to ring. I'll have to do that tomorrow, but I really would have preferred to ring this patient today. And you leave work with a real sense of dissatisfaction with the quality of the work that you've given. Being able to document is quite therapeutic for yourself in writing down what you couldn't do. That in itself helps. But I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Phil Hammond. He's a GP, but he's also on the radio and he writes books about the NHS. And he refers to a thing called the National Institute of Good Enough, NIGE. Okay. Because the specialist nurses, the NHS, it's all we've got to be striving and delivering an excellent, exemplary service all of the time. And sometimes good enough is okay. We're doing the fundamentals of our care, we're keeping patients safe. And sometimes in the situations throughout COVID and now catching up from COVID and with reduced staff, it's okay to be NIGE. Okay, so sometimes the National Institute of Good Enough is okay. But what I would say is that documenting what you haven't been able to do, either at the end of a day or do, I used to like at the Homerton doing snapshots, which were small collections of data, mainly because I didn't like having to collect lots of data all of the time. And you know what I'm like with a spreadsheet, not good. So I would do a snapshot. I'd go, right, this week we're going to measure blah. So 1 week we measured how many phone calls we got into the service with queries from GPs, from other doctors, from consultants, from patients that we had to answer and respond to. Then I did, if we didn't do telephone calls, this I documented just one call that I did out of eight this particular day to patients, and we've already discussed that. So I would do a snapshot of, in this week, these are the things that either myself as an individual nurse specialist or the team of stomach care and colorectal nurse specialists were not able to achieve. And with the proviso, patients were safe, but this was not an exemplary service. And if this is a snapshot of just 1 week, but this is what happens every week. So work left undone is the things that actually we normally don't measure because we're frightened to say, I didn't do this, and then get some well-meaning manager start performance managing us because why didn't you do this? Or we need to write a datex because you didn't do this. So I think it's work left undone is the challenge for nursing across the board at the moment. I think, you know, when you look at the challenges on a daily basis for ward-based staff, with the number of vacancies, bank and agency staff, they are constantly not being able to do what they want to do for their allocated patients. So I think it's really important to think of this as advocacy. If we don't tell our managers in a considered snapshot case study type of way what we can't deliver for our patients, we're not advocating for them. We're not advocating for ourselves, and we're not advocating for our service and our patients. And as nurses, we do like to crack on quite a bit with the I'm the patient's advocate. Well, this kind of work, although not directly patient facing, is advocacy. Advocacy for the service that those patients are getting. So I think it's really, really important. And as you mentioned with the Apollo website, part of the reason that Apollo came into being to give people the tools and the confidence to be able to advocate for different aspects of their service. So not just this is my job plan, but this is snapshot issues that my service is experiencing.
Brilliant. And I think, again, there's one thing there that I'd like to almost pull out, and it's that fear. And I always used to explain it that 100% one day is going to be less than 100% the next. Every day I go to work, I always give 100%, but what is 100% one day potentially is going to be 80% the next day because of extrinsic factors that are completely out of my control.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned that, you know, we've mentioned managers quite a lot here, but obviously there are different audiences for case studies. And, you know, you mentioned that you did these snapshot in time things at the Homerton. And again, when I talk to nurses think of case studies. Hopefully they, you know, you've changed their mind already. But what do you actually, once you've done this case snapshot, once you've done that case study, once you've had a really interesting experience, you've managed the situation really well, something's come up, it's the first time you might have had Caput Medusa and or anything like that, and you go, oh, this was absolutely brilliant. What do you do with those case studies? What sort of impact can they have? Where do you send them? Because obviously we don't want them just to sit in a folder on someone's desktop, because they're not doing anything when they're sitting in that folder.
So I think you've got to be really clear when you're documenting something. Am I documenting this case study, which doesn't have to be 2,500 words referenced and referring to best practice? It can be a documentary case study. Is this for internal use, for me to present a case for an improvement within my staffing or my service or whatever? Or is this for external readers to learn from either a novel or challenging clinical situation and the solution that I found for managing it? So I think there are multiple uses for this, but actually you have to be really clear before you start. Because if we're writing for our peers to learn from a clinical situation, we need some photographs probably. So as you're writing, you know, before you write the case study, as you're experiencing this clinical situation, you have to, no, we need photos for this. This is going to show what I'm doing. This is going to show what the problem is. So I think that be very clear at the beginning and don't be put off by case study. Because when I think of case study, I think of when I was doing my master's and degree, and I think, oh, it's really formal. It's a significant word count. It has a significant kind of heading, or it's kind of key headings and the format you've got to write it. And externally for publication, yes, there is more rigor to the format. You know, many can be one page. Many case studies can make fantastic posters at conferences. So be clear of what the reason for them is. And internal case studies, just to make a point, can be really, really short. I mean, I literally, two paragraphs can be a snapshot case study, allowing a manager or non-clinical person to understand a problem in a more real world way.
And I think that's it. It's making people understand, or putting things in a format that is appropriate to the listener, to the person that is receiving it. So if we're talking annual reports, and I remember, you know, Terry, you taught me how to do an annual report, and you know, you literally ground it into me what should be included. And when you're sending out an annual report, send it to every man and his dog, including their secretary if they have one. It doesn't matter, literally do it to the inbox. And if you are sending it to the finance guys, don't just send out a generic email. Actually say, you know, I'd like you to pay special attention to page 8 and 9, you know, where you put down how much stock and how much, you know, stuff we've received from, you know, pens, papers, post-its, all of those sorts of things. We've saved you money because as clinical nurse specialists, as part of the service, we talk to private companies. They give us all this stock and that sort of thing. So we've saved you that much money. Now, you've mentioned, you know, you have different receivers of these case studies. And you've mentioned things like the snapshot, like you did that brilliant one where you said of the telephone call, or you've done, you know, that two paragraph thing, which then leads me to that question is what should be included? Is there, you know, a one kind of framework that fits all? Or if you're doing something to one type of stakeholder, do some sort of format or, you know, inclusion, what to include?
Okay, so if we think internally and we think about things that we're going to put in an annual report or some kind of letter or statement to our managers about making some kind of improvement or to the service, or for them to understand a specific challenge to the service that they need to support us to rectify. As we spoke earlier, it's about who is your audience? So it's an internal audience, it's an external audience. What are the key things you want them to understand? So I used to practice, and I'm sure all of you do, when we deliver a service and you think, if this was my mum or my brother or my dad, this is how I would want them to be treated. I always used to look at these snapshots as my more informal, not double blind, randomized control, whatever, my more informal way to allow whoever I want to influence, if it could be the chief nurse, it could be the finance officer, it could be the commissioning lead for the community, whoever it is that you're wanting to influence to change or improve your service, you want them to look through your eyes in the same way as you. We want them to understand, if this was your mum or dad, would it be good enough? Because that's how our minds think. And I think there are opportunity to give people an emotional kind of view of what it is like to face-to-face care for somebody. Because I think, you know, unless you're in a patient-facing role, it's hard sometimes not to see this as transactional, as numbers on a spreadsheet of tariff, of, you know, what the service can claim for and the income it can generate. But also, I think, and as Professor Alison Leary talks a lot about, you think it's expensive to hire or to have pay an expert like me or another expert specialist nurse. And this quote from Red Adair with the oil refinery fires, you think it's expensive to hire me because I'm an expert to put these out? Have a go with somebody who's not an expert and see how much it costs you. It's that kind of vision. And there's areas and some example articles and text on the Apollo website, Paul, that with work written by Professor Leary, where she does identify the importance of identifying work left undone. If we think in our own lives, we go somewhere for a service. I go to have my car serviced. And if when I pick it up, they haven't done something, but they haven't told me they haven't done it, it's not okay for me on the receiving end, but also for that service, because it might be something safety critical with my car and they've not told me, they haven't fixed it. So, you know, if we put ourselves into a position like that where we're on the receiving end of a service and something doesn't get done, how can that service improve if you and the person don't say, we didn't have time on this occasion to, but if you bring it in next week, we will change that tire because it's get. Do you understand? So I think if we just try and put this, rather than this formality of business cases and business plans, think about what it would be like for us on the receiving end of a service that didn't do everything it said it was going to do and the issue it might cause me, and more cost it might cause me. And then we can write in a way, because we have that understanding, like we want our managers to understand, well, if this was my mum, if this was my dad, is it good enough? We need to reflect on the challenges of not reporting what we don't do and it's significant. If we don't get people to understand what we don't do, we'll have a problem trying to then present the argument of why we need to increase headcount or change the times of our clinics or whatever, because we've glossed over that bit. As nurses, we have a duty of candor, so we have to say when it's not going tip top, okay? And we have to say, this happened. Actually, we found this out and we stopped A and B happening, but it was by luck. That could have been. We have to highlight this because that could have been a serious clinical incident for that patient.
I think that's amazing. You know, you spoke there about fear, and I think for a lot of nurses, we do a really good job. We love thinking that we do a really good job. We love telling people that we do a good job. But sometimes I think we get afraid of saying, actually, we're not that good at X, or this couldn't happen because of I tried, but I just couldn't. And actually vocalizing that in the form of a case study and that sort of thing, hopefully is empowering and saying, you know, yes, we need to speak up for our service. But at the end of the day, we also speak up for the patients as well. And if we didn't have a service, what would happen to them? And I think, as you said, case studies are a phenomenal way and a powerful way to do that. And I love the fact that you said, you know, it doesn't have to be reams and reams. It's not 2,000 words. It can be two paragraphs. It's however the format to put that case study through is almost dependent on the situation. So like you said, you know, sometimes, yeah, pictures are absolutely fantastic, but sometimes it's not appropriate and it's just words, it's breaking it down. So I love the fact that I say there is no golden template for a case study. And Terry, you're going to love my last little bit. Okay, my last question to you. Okay, I want to see that smile when I say, Terry, what are your top tips for writing case studies? I know I had to put Terry's top tips in.
Okay, first of all, my top tip is do not overcomplicate or overthink an internal case study. Okay, a case study that you are using a snapshot for your argument. Don't overthink it. Don't overcomplicate it. This is not a randomized controlled trial. Nobody expects it to be. Okay. The second thing is be really clear of who you're writing to, because quite often it will be a specific person or a group of people that you need for them to understand a particular. So be really clear who your audience is. Okay. The third thing, I suppose, is get a not. So I always used to test out a lot of things I'd written in my annual report on my brother. My brother's not medical at all. And I would say to him, can you understand what I'm saying here? Because most of my audience that I was trying to inform and change things weren't medical. So if my brother could get it, I knew that they would understand what I'm saying. And if he'd say, I don't understand that word, and why is that important? I knew I had to write more to explain those things. My top tip would be get somebody who doesn't know your service inside out like you to read it and go, yeah, I get exactly in those two paragraphs, I get what you're saying. Okay. So I think that's three. Four is, as Paul said, once you've written an annual report or a snapshot, email it to whoever it is you need to email with a personal covering letter, you know, personal covering email to each of them, so that you're telling them in your email why they are so important and can directly impact on the improvement of patient care. So if you make somebody feel, okay, all I've got to do is say yes to that, and I'm going to improve things for patients. People really like that. Really like that. And the fifth thing I would say is once you've done one, do more, because they are really, really powerful. And they can be short and sweet and really targeted. And it saves you doing a million and one business cases. So that's Terry's top tips.
So there you go. Case studies aren't so boring after all. Thanks to Dr. Terry Porritt for taking the time to chat with Paul. We've put together a handout to go alongside this episode, and it's available in the show notes for you to download right now. Thank you for listening to Stoma and Contents Conversations, and we'll be back with another episode for you next week.
Stoma and Continence Conversations is brought to you by Coloplast Professional. To learn more, visit coloplastprofessional.co.uk.